Welcome to Voices for Change 2.0, the only podcast that focuses on mental health while mixing in movies, music, books, sports, and pop culture. Here are your hosts, Rebecca and Joe Lombardo.
Hello, and welcome to Voices for Change 2.0. We are glad to have you with us.
Yes, thanks for being with us today. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule to listen to us today. We do appreciate you.
Today we're speaking with one of the nation's leading advocates for addiction recovery. He's been featured by the Huffington Post, USA Today, LA Times, and more. He's spoken with policy advisors in the Obama White House and also at the 2016 Democratic National Convention. And now we have the honor of talking with him on our little show. Please welcome the guy who's changing the way America looks at addiction, Mr. Ryan Hampton.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Great to join you on the podcast today, and I'm incredibly grateful for this opportunity.
Well, thanks for talking with us today, Ryan. We really do appreciate it, and it truly is an honor having you on the show. You know, you've been very, very active in the world of addiction recovery and, you know, raising awareness on it. And, you know, it's a topic that we haven't talked about that much on the show. So we're really happy to have you on to shed a little light and break a little stigma.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm particularly interested in speaking with you, you know, just as a little side for something personal. I have a brother who actually passed away from addiction. He started his alcoholism the year I was born, 1973, and he was an alcoholic his entire life, and he ended up passing away due to that. So addiction and especially alcohol recovery is a topic that's close to my heart.
I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, it's unfortunately a story that I hear way too often, and I think a story that most Americans hear too often. You know, addiction, specifically the opioid crisis, but addiction in general, and alcoholism is our leading, in my humble opinion, leading public health crisis right now. And it needs to be dealt with precision as a public health problem. You know, with alcoholism and addiction together, the numbers are pretty staggering. I mean, we're losing about 125,000 people per year, which is about 350 per day when you include alcoholism, you know, addiction, whether it's prescription medication or heroin or other substances. And I think it's just clear that the way that we've been dealing with it hasn't been working. The one unifying factor that I can see, though, is that this is certainly not a Republican issue or a Democratic issue or even a political issue. It is a very mainstream issue that affects all communities. It crosses all borders, socioeconomic, race, religion, class. It doesn't matter where you come from. And people, you know, they want solutions. And as I think a country, and that's why I respect so much what you, Rebecca, and Joe do, you know, your Keep Talking Mental Health hashtag, we need to be talking, not just keep talking. We need to start talking about addiction in this country. We've seen that emerging as a movement over the last couple of years. You know, people need not sweep this issue under the rug anymore, because how are we ever going to get to solutions? How are we ever going to get our insurance cards to work? How are we ever going to get people to accept us for who we are if they don't know us? The other thing I would say is, you know, I understand this is the top blog or blog podcast for mental health. You know, I don't believe at my core that we can address addiction without addressing mental health also.
Right.
You know, I lost a very good friend of mine just this past Sunday two days ago, because I know this is airing Saturday, a guy I'd been working with, young guy, 22 years old, overdosed on his mom's couch and, you know, paid the ultimate price and died. And there were a lot of co-occurring mental health issues that I know that he was dealing with, and they were untreated. And I think that, you know, as a nation, we've kind of looked at this model of approaching addiction almost as if it were a social network. And I mean, listen, community is the most important factor in recovering from addiction and substances and alcoholism. You have to have a sense of community. You have to have peer-to-peers. But that is certainly not the only way to do this. And there are people out there who need more help than just that peer-to-peer led community support. They need to see a doctor. They need to they need to have an assessment and evaluation, because more often than not, that addiction is being driven by an underlying co-occurring mental health issue that's not being addressed.
Right. Exactly.
Agreed. And we're sorry for the loss of your friend, incidentally.
Yes, we are.
That's tragic.
I don't think that addiction comes from nowhere. You know, I know that it does have a tendency to run in families, but I don't think it just starts from nowhere. I think there's always, if not, you know, almost always, and some underlying type of mental health. You know, I'm sure depression would be ranked up there as one of the highest reasons for people to begin drinking to begin with. So
right, just to take away the
sure.
pain.
Exactly.
You know.
So, you know, and
there's that. There's, you know, genetic predispositions. I know of that. There's a reason why I never really took to drinking, and that's because my uncle is a recovered alcoholic, and you know, I saw what it did to him when I was very young, and you know, thank God he found recovery and has been sober for probably a good 30-35 years now.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a true success story. Yep. That's great.
Exactly. You know, but you know, knowing what he went through and whatnot, I never opened myself up to the temptation of it because I saw what he went through, you know, and, you know, living on people's couches and bouncing from friend's house to friend's house and whatnot. So, yeah. Hey,
I think,
Ryan,
you know, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, we do have some questions to jump into just to get
sure.
the people acquainted with you a little bit. If that's okay, and we could pursue that.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So let's start at the beginning. What actually drove you to addiction, and what did you struggle with?
Sure. So I'm in recovery from heroin addiction. There were probably a lot of indicators that could have been problematic in my life, but nothing that led me, you know, directly into addiction. I mean, I had a lot of issues as a kid growing up. I mean, there were a lot of, you know, sexual identity issues. There was a lot of, you know, sexual abuse at a younger age. You know, but I kind of, the way that I had dealt with it is I became an adult very quick. Even when I was 15 years old, I started working. I had a real appetite for politics and policy, and I was kind of like this weird nerd kid, and nobody understood me because I was always off volunteering for campaigns. And, you know, I ended up landing an internship at the White House, which put me on this trajectory of, you know, employment within the political sphere. So I worked for the National Party and the State Party and some senators and Congress people and, you know, former Attorney General of the U.S. and ran some campaigns and did some communications work. But in the thick of the 2004 presidential election, actually 2003, to answer your question, what led me to take a real nosedive into addiction was I broke my ankle. And I was in Maryland. I had experimented with drugs, as most kids in college do, and I drank some, but it had never reached a threshold of you have a problem. You know, it was very, you know, sporadic, to say it best. I broke my ankle hiking in Maryland with some friends and went to an urgent pain care clinic to get it checked out. And, you know, they wrapped it and they said, you need to see a specialist about this. And they handed me a prescription for hydromorphone, which for your listeners who may not know what that is, it's also branded under the name Dilaudid. It is a powerful. It's certainly the good stuff. It is a very powerful opioid medication. And I, you know, felt better, obviously. The pain went away, and I went back to work, and I started walking on this ankle. And, you know, 2 weeks go by, and I hadn't had it checked out. And I went back to the doctor, and I said, hey, can I get some more of the pain medicine? I said, sure. And, you know, eventually the pain kind of dulled off, but the feeling that I was getting from the medication, I liked it. And it kind of went on and off for a while I was in D.C. and eventually moved back to Florida. And this was back in 2005. And if you know anything about South Florida, specifically in 2005, it was at the height of what was called the pill mill epidemic. Very lax regulation. Purdue Pharma, you know, now has paid tremendous fines. Mallinckrodt has paid tremendous fines. They were directly marketing their opioid pain medications to doctors and to physicians, and physicians who weren't even in the pain business were opening up pain clinics. It was just this booming economy in South Florida, going all the way up to Kentucky. They used to call it the OxyContin Express. And, you know, I ended up at one of these doctors who prescribed me a tremendous amount of opioids. And, you know, without getting into too much of the details, I got hooked. One day, a couple years later, I had been seeing, you know, actually a couple of doctors where I was getting prescriptions from. I showed up at one of my doctor's offices, said, hey, you know, it's time for my re-up for my script. And they looked at me and they said, we think you're drug-seeking. You know, it looks like you've been going to more doctors. And I said, yes, I have. Obviously, I have a problem, but what do I do? And the doctor looked at me and said, I don't know, but what I can tell you is get the hell out of my office. If you show back up here, we're going to have you arrested. You can't be doing this here in the state of Florida. I could lose my license and blah, blah, blah. And I walked out of the doctor's office, and I think it was within a couple of hours I scored my first bag of heroin. That's important to note, though, because anybody who understands opioid addiction or knows someone who is addicted to an opioid or heroin or prescription pain pill knows that there is a physical component to the addiction. I mean, it wasn't
right.
It was I physically could not function without that substance in my body. So my and I didn't know anything at the time about what even recovery was. I didn't know that there were programs of recovery, or I was very, very naive. As smart as I think I was, I was very naive when it came to, hey, there's options here. There's rehabs, there's doctors, there's, you know, people you can talk to, there's peers. None of that was made clear to me. All I knew is that I needed my fix, or else I was going to get very sick. And I had to keep working so that I could keep paying for my addiction, and that set me off onto, you know, a downward spiral of heroin addiction that almost took my life, you know, on multiple occasions.
What made you decide to finally get help?
Well, it was, I was out here in Los Angeles, and it was the night before Thanksgiving, 2015. And I had known for some time at this point that I had a real problem. I mean, I was paying some serious consequences in my life. You know, family and friends and, you know, employers and just people didn't want anything to do with me. I was homeless, you know, couch surfing, and I was about to be kicked out of an apartment that I was in. I wanted help. My life had gotten to a point where I just realized it was either I was going to get help or I was going to die. And I knew that, and it really impacted me to listen to my mom tell me that. and begged me to get help. And you know, there really wasn't anything to lose at the point. And I did want my life back, as impossible as it seemed. The only problem with that was, for about 45 days, I didn't have insurance. I didn't have money, as many of us do when we get to that point where we're ready for help. There was nobody out there really that could help me. I needed a medical detox. I needed medical stabilization before I could even think right. I needed to be put somewhere and monitored and watched. You know, there was a lot at stake there, and I couldn't find a place that would take me because no one, you know, I mean, you need money to do these things. And so I was, you know, calling public treatment centers and calling, you know, county facilities and, you know, day after day and asking if there was a bed available, and they would tell me call back tomorrow, and being put on waiting lists. And I mean, it was some of the most terrifying moments of my life. And eventually one of them did pick up and say, hey, you know, we have a bed, come on in. And I ended up going to it, and it was a public facility, and they kept me for 4 or 5 days for a very brief detox. And I thought I was going to be staying there for longer term treatment, and I ended up, you know, getting discharged because they didn't have enough beds in their longer term treatment, and which is a huge part of the problem. You know, and eventually I did get, I mean, with the help of my mother, God bless her. I mean, she, while I was in that detox, she really worked the phones and found a scholarship for me and, you know, helped pay a little bit of the money to cover the gap from the scholarship. And I got into a program by a tremendous amount of grace and a tremendous amount of luck. And it saved my life. And here I am today.
That's awesome. I mean, it's terrible that you had to go through that, but it's awesome that you were able to find the help that you needed.
And yet you stuck with it. You stuck with it until you found the help, because that's, you know, you have to have that type of mindset. It's like Dr. Phil always says, unless and until, you know, until you get that mindset, you won't ever get free from the demon that's holding you back.
Right.
So you just, it's amazing that you are able to keep, you know,
having the persistence and the will to live to want to succeed with it.
Yeah, exactly.
So
I mean, the hardest part though, getting the help and persisting. I mean, yes, I'm so grateful that I did it, obviously, because I don't know if I'd even be here today. But the hardest part for me really wasn't even the persistence part and the going after and the hustling to get into a treatment and getting help. The hardest part for me was admitting to myself and admitting to my family that I actually had a problem, even though it was so clear that I did. I mean, all the indicators were pointing in that direction. I mean, it was like a fact. But I internally still had this huge problem inside saying, hey, I have a problem with heroin. My life is falling apart. I might die from it. And it was hard to actually say those words to my mom and hard to say those words to my friends and family, because we have, for decades in this country, we haven't looked at addiction as a public health problem. We've looked at it as a moral problem. We've looked at it as less than, that you're not, you know. And so all of that growing up, you know, I mean, I can remember the coloring books and the police officers and the, you know, them coming in and the songs and the egg frying on the pan and the, you know, the guys smoking crack in the alleyways, the commercials. And I mean, culture and society has taught us that people with addiction are bad people who make bad choices. And the truth of the matter is we really are at our core good people, most of us, with a bad health problem, and we need help. And so it's like the more people that are willing to ask for help, I think, you know, and the more that we can open that dialogue and that conversation and normalize addiction, like we need to normalize it, you know, by talking about it, I think the further along we'll get, the more progress we'll make.
Yeah, you know, when we were growing up, it was kind of beaten into our heads, you know, the two S's, stigma and shame, you know? And so, yeah, it's not enough to, you know, rationally say in your head, I have this problem, and then verbalizing it to all your loved ones. It's the, you know, you're thinking, oh my God, I'm telling everyone I love that I have this problem. I'm such a terrible person. And the reality is you're not. You're just, you know, you have this health problem and you realize that you need the help. It's that stigma and shame that is harder to overcome than anything.
And there's a lot of things behind that. I mean, I do understand. I mean, I get beat up all the time about it when I use certain analogies with other health issues, because look, I mean, addiction, it's no secret that it leads people to do some pretty awful things sometimes. It leads people to do things that are, you know, crimes and, you know, what, prostitution or stealing. I mean, it leads people to make bad choices. It leads people to not be their best selves, obviously. It is all part of that monster. And because of those actions, people look at this differently. Look, if you have cancer and you're dying on your deathbed or you're getting chemotherapy, people are rushing to you and they want to help and bake pies and, you know,
right,
kids. And I mean, people are very quick to respond to that. People who have cancer aren't out, you know, robbing a jewelry store or stealing from their mom's purse to pay for their drugs. I mean,
right,
that's what, you know, more often than not, it's a story with people with addiction, you know, or a good group of us. But with that being said, it is a brain chemical response. I mean, your brain, my brain at least, went into survival mode when I was using.
Right.
I mean, there was really no choice. I mean, I'm not a bad person, but I mean, if there was a choice of, hey, take $20 out of mom's wallet or sit in bed and throw up and be sick and miserable and like feel like you're dying, you're going to go for the $20. So, I mean, it is a, you know, and that's why we do need to be looking at this medically, you know.
Right.
I mean, we can't just say, hey, you're going to stop using drugs and that's it. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, we're in 2017. There's a lot of science out there now. I mean, the conclusion from science is that, you know, this is a chronic brain illness, you know, and that we need to be looking at not just, you know, the abstinence phase. We need to be looking at the brain chemistry, too. We need to be looking at other pathways and options that people have, because there's a lot out there. And I mean, we wouldn't be, you know, I mean, even look at mental health and like bipolar disorder and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at how the medications have evolved in the last 30, 40 years, you know, for
right,
all mental health issues. I mean, we're still pretty stuck in this mindset of abstinence only. Now, while that's my path, that is my personal pathway to recovery, it's definitely not one size fits all. I mean, I've met people who have died in the process of seeking recovery because people say, hey, medication isn't a good thing and you're not really in recovery unless you're completely abstinent. I mean, that's totally BS. I mean, recovery is a personal definition in my opinion.
Right, and everybody handles it a different way. You know, it's no different than, you know, bipolar or any other mental illness. You know, a treatment that works for one person isn't necessarily going to work for the next person. Hey, Ryan, we have to take a quick break. So that's what we're going to do. We will be right back. We're going to be playing Matt Van Fossen's Where Are You Going to Run To Now?
Virginia, how we just couldn't sleep in the bed that you made. We gonna run to now. We gonna run to now. Radio on, coffee black in your cup. Don't know where you're going, only know you can't stop. We gonna run to now. waking up, reaching out to hold you, offering the love, fading in your rear view. We gonna run to now, we gonna run to now. Tomorrow coming fast over the horizon, Jesus on the dash, devil riding shotgun. We gonna run.
Welcome back to Voices for Change 2.0. I'm Joe. Rebecca is sitting right next to me, and we've got on the line Mr. Ryan Hampton. Thanks again for being with us, Ryan. We appreciate you taking the time out of your day to talk to us.
It's great to be here. I'm really enjoying this conversation.
So are we.
Yes,
so are
absolutely.
We.
So are we. So, Ryan, from my point, what motivated you to come forward publicly with your addiction?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, for a little background, I had been in and out of trying to get sober for a long time, you know, since 2006, and never really stuck and never really experienced kind of what I experienced in early of 2016 or late 2015, early 2016. I was very afraid to talk about my addiction. I was very afraid to talk about even my recovery. Outside of like my peers that I was close to, I didn't want anybody to know I was living in a sober living. You know, people would tag me in photos on Facebook and I'd say, hey, please untag me. I don't want them to know I'm even with you because you're in recovery and like, I don't want to be associated with it. And I mean, I was really, really careful. You know, outside of my close, not even my whole family, my close family, my immediate family, and like some of my best friends who knew. That all changed in October 2015. You know, I was sitting on a deck at my sober living and came across my screen. One of the guys I was, you know, who I got sober with was found dead in his sober living from an overdose, and it impacted me. And, you know, people started telling me, hey, this is going to keep happening. You know, it happens a lot when you get into recovery. Well, you know, I had been out there using heroin for over a decade, and I don't remember people dying like they have recently.
Right.
A couple weeks later, a guy I was living with, actually, one of my roommates, had a relapse, and he went to the hospital to tell them he needed help because he didn't have insurance or money, and said, hey, I've relapsed. You know, that was at my advice, actually. I said, hey, man, go to the hospital. Maybe they can point you in the right direction and get you some help. The hospital, the ER people there said, hey, this is like an acute problem. We don't really know what to do, but here's a piece of paper with a bunch of different organizations you can call. You know, we suggest you kind of dry out and call them tomorrow when you sober up. And he was on heroin at the time. And the next morning, woke up, and, you know, we found his body a couple blocks away from our house.
Wow.
And he had died that night. To make things worse, I mean, it was only 2 or 3 weeks later that one of my closest friends, who I was in treatment with and had gotten close to, and my community had gotten close to, overdosed and died on a trip back home, or a visit back home in Texas. And so, you know, these things happening, and I began to get very angry. I guess
yeah.
you could say I started, you know, really looking under the hood of why this is happening. Why are people dying? Why are my, not just people, but like, why are my friends? Why are these
your friends.
People that I've built these relationships with and gotten close to, you know, dropping off like flies? And it didn't stop there. I mean, the death kept rolling in. And I started looking into, you know, going online and came across a nonprofit called Facing Addiction, which was doing some amazing work in breaking stigma. And they had an event in Washington, D.C. that I caught on Facebook Live, where it was these performers like Steven Tyler's and Joe Walsh's and Sheryl Crow, and, you know, then recovery advocates from all around the country. And, you know, there was, you know, 40,000 people on the National Mall in recovery and parents of loss. And the message that night of this rally they had called Unite to Face Addiction was, we will not be silent anymore. You know, we need people to listen to us. We're, you know, we want to celebrate recovery, but we also are outraged about our community dying. I mean, it was a really interesting balance. And I watched it and I related. I mean, I felt their sense of purpose. I felt their sense of pride. I felt their sense of outrage. And I knew at that moment that I had found a community that I could join, a movement that I could be a part of. And I reached out to them, and I started learning from people who had told their stories before. And, you know, they taught me, they said, hey, the first step really is you've got to, you know, if you're comfortable, because it's a personal decision, you need to tell your story, you know, and you need to figure out how you want to do it when you're ready. And so that's what I did. I wrote an op-ed, which was picked up locally, and then, you know, it went viral on Huffington Post and viral on Upworthy and a couple other platforms, and I started writing about it a lot. And the response that I received was, I had people from all over the country who were, you know, messaging me on Facebook and emailing me and finding me and saying, hey, your story's my story. Like, how do I tell my story? And I saw the guys I was living with in my sober living, you know, start telling their stories, and, you know, and our this ripple effect in our community. And I knew intrinsically, I knew that it was the right thing to do, to tell my story at every opportunity I had and inspire others to do the same.
That's awesome. You know, just that it caught fire, and, you know, it's inspiring. It's funny because
it runs parallel with the mental health, you know, the separate, you know, bipolar mental health movement. It runs exactly parallel, because I've actually told that same story you just told. But from my perspective, when I came out and told my story from my suicide attempt and you know, everything that followed after that, and that's what my book is about and everything. So it runs exactly parallel with what you were just saying.
I was just about to say that. That's funny. You know, but it's a great feeling, you know.
Yeah, it's a good feeling. I mean, it was certainly empowering, not just to me, but my community. And, you know, one kind of what I figured, I mean, it was really an amazing feeling when I started seeing all these people telling their stories. The other thing, though, the second thing that I noticed was, you know, where we're at in the recovery movement, where we're at in addiction recovery issues in general with policy and, you know, people who are making our laws, like, how are we ever going to get favorable legislation or things passed or changes made if the country didn't know who we were? And so as more people tell their stories, and like me, I had a lot of people just personally come up to me and say, I didn't know you struggled with a heroin addiction. I didn't know you didn't want to talk about this. I didn't know what your pathway was. I didn't know the journey that brought you here. And they would say, hey, you know what? I know someone, or, you know, I've met members of Congress or local public policymakers, you know, CEOs who their perception on this issue shifted 180 degrees, not because of data that they saw, but because of heart, because they knew somebody, because they met somebody, and they immediately connected with what the issue really was. It no longer became like a chart on a wall of overdose deaths and causes and, you know, everything they could tie to it. It became someone they knew or someone that was in their living room. And that shift in attitude is really what we need, because everybody knows someone. I mean, that is, you know, I mean, that's a fact.
Yeah, it's when you can put a face to a situation, it hits home a lot more than just reading, you know,
tweet after tweet after tweet after
tweet. Or, you know, a random story about this person that lives five states away or what have you. When you actually got it in your wheelhouse, that's really when it starts to make an impact, you know.
It is probably the, you know, the secret weapon. And I know that you relate to this, but it is our community's secret weapon, because the number, I mean, the math and the history are on our side. I mean, that's just a fact. I mean, there's 1 in 3 households in the United States impacted by substance use disorder. There's 45 million Americans facing addiction. You know, you're looking at about 22 million that are out there suffering, most of them in silence. You're looking at about another 23 million that are already living in long-term recovery. I mean, these are astronomical numbers. So this is not an anonymous population. This is a population that has a voice. A lot of them pay taxes. A lot of them vote. It's like the more that we make ourselves known and kick down those closet doors, the further we're going to get along in ending this crisis. In my opinion, what is, you know, the top health crisis of this generation, quickly and more efficiently and with precision and with greater outcomes.
Right.
Absolutely. Would you mind telling us a little bit about the Addiction X America project?
Sure, I'd love to. I mean, Addiction X America, following that whole story that I just told you about losing a lot of my friends, we had, after beginning to tell our stories on a larger platform, our community, we decided we really wanted to take that project on the road. This time last summer, actually, we were just pulling out of Philadelphia. And the idea behind it was I would run for delegate to the Democratic National Convention. I had no expectations to win. It was really to get our community together to show up at a place where a lot of influential policymakers would be at in one location, which was this caucus election, and tell our stories. We registered a lot of people in recovery from heroin addiction. Most of them young, who had never been registered before. You know, we showed up in this mass amount. There were 70 of us. There were, you know, 600 people that were at the caucus to vote. There were, I think, 72 candidates on the ballot. We had only organized from within our community. And when we got there, I was like, hey, we're kind of outgunned here. You know, let's just talk to as many people as we can and let them know why we're doing this and why we're here. And that's what we did. And much to my surprise, as we worked that line and as I worked that line, probably 1 in 3 people I talked to, you know, I'd tell them who I was, what my story was, why I was doing it. And somebody in that line would say, hey, my brother is in treatment, or I grew up in an alcoholic household. I had a grandmother tell me about how she had lost her granddaughter a few weeks prior to an overdose down in Texas. And I saw that people were eager to have this conversation. We were the ones that needed to start it. and much to my surprise, you know, won the election, became a delegate, and decided, you know, well, what's the next step? How are we going to keep talking about this? How are we going to keep this momentum and keep talking about it? And my best friend and I decided we were going to drive across the country. We weren't just going to fly to the convention and just be another bystander there. We were going to drive across the country, and we were going to stop in every community on the way there and every community on the way back and talk to as many people as possible, video it, get it on YouTube as quickly as possible, and, you know, raise awareness from the platform that we currently had at the time, which was and continues to be digital. You know, we crisscrossed the country and hit 22 states, logged about 8,000 miles and did it in 31 days and documented it in a 7-part YouTube series, short series called Facing Addiction Across America. The hashtag was AddictionXAmerica. And I was surprised that it picked up a lot of steam. You know, we went into jails, we went into treatment centers, we went into peer-to-peer programs, we talked to advocates, we talked to people who were telling their stories for the first time, we talked to parents who had lost a kid, and we just wanted to raise their stories up as much as possible so that the rest of the country could hear from all different geographic locations. And that was really the birth, you know, that trip was a personal journey for me. When I got home and it was over, you know, I knew inside that it couldn't stop there, that that really was just the beginning. So we've been working with nonprofits. We've been working with advocacy leaders. We've been working with policymakers. We've been working with parents of loss. We've been working with healthcare organizations to continue that message. And that's really where the Voices Project started. I think as many people did and your audience, you know, will agree, social media, I saw in 2016 the power of social media during the campaign. Everybody was using it. And you could reach, I mean, like, you know, people really aren't watching as much TV these days, but they are spending time on Facebook. They are spending time on YouTube. They are spending time on Twitter. And so I decided that was the platform, and I saw a huge void. A huge gap when it came to talking about addiction recovery on social media. So the decision was we're going to do this on social media and we're going to reach as many people as we can.
Wow. That's
an amazing story.
Very visionary, yeah. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Voices Project in a minute, but we do have one more break that we're going to take.
And you will be listening to Damian Escobar. Welcome back to Voices for Change 2.0. This is Rebecca talking, and you know that I'm sitting right here next to my amazing husband of nearly 16 years. We are having our 16-year anniversary August 3rd, so I just wanted to give him a little shout-out because he gave me very beautiful roses yesterday a little bit early.
Oh, thanks, honey.
But we are talking to an amazing advocate in Ryan Hampton. And Ryan, we're so glad to have you with us. Would you mind telling us a little bit about what the hashtag Voices project is?
Sure. By the way, congratulations on your anniversary. That's pretty amazing.
Thank you.
16 years is a big deal. And Joe, good job on getting her the roses.
Thanks.
Very happy. Voices project. So, you know, to kind of close out what I was talking about, Addiction X America, I mean, Voices Project hashtag was really a continuation of the Addiction Across America tour. You know, I've met so many people, and they all had faces, and they all had voices. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, how do we, you know, when building this social media platform, you know, the whole purpose of it was never for me to get on there and, you know, tell people what I thought and keep telling my story. No, what I saw was empower in other people telling their stories and building this constituency of consequence. So I was sitting at home with my best friend Garrett one night, and I'm thinking, like, how do we get these stories out here? I keep hearing, you know, from all these people around the country who are, you know, not just in recovery, but they're doing these amazing things in their community. How do we fit them in this, and how do we fit the parents in, and how do we fit the legislators that want to talk about this issue in? Like, what do we do? Mm-hmm. And I was like, it came to me, and I said, well, that's it. Like, let's start a project. Let's call it the Voices Project. Let's, you know, open it up to, you know, basically an open forum for people to tell their recovery story. People are eager to get their story out there. And, you know, I knew at the beginning that I would get some pushback because I didn't, you know, the one thing that I made clear was, like, I will let anybody tell their story that's involved in this space, as long as it's not for a profit motive or you're trying to sell something or get someone to go to a particular treatment facility, because we have a lot of that in this space and it's not authentic. I feel very strongly about that, but I knew that, you know, we would get some pushback from that community because, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to sell people's stories and bring them to their particular center.
They have an agenda.
One specific pathway. They have an agenda. One specific pathway they only want to sell. No, I wanted to show all different pathways. I wanted to show that people could recover from addiction, whether it's a 12-step group or it's their faith, or whether it was a friend that they're working with who's helping them get sober, or whether they just realized they wanted to stop, or whether they're using medication, or whatever it may be. Let's be inclusive. Mm-hmm. Let's build a big tent for recovery. Let's unify this space, and let's call it the Voices Project. And we, you know, we're doing it in a partnership with a nonprofit facing addiction. They're running the Voices Project also, and we've started to see people using the hashtag, and, you know, collectively, you know, people submit their stories. We get them up on social media really quickly. We're putting them up on a website. But collectively, we're reaching on social media, you know, this month alone, it's anywhere between 4 to 5 million people. I mean, so people are reading these stories and they're wanting to submit their own. And I've got this huge, I mean, and the eagerness of people to tell their stories and get their voice out there. It's really fascinating. I mean, we've got this huge backlog, and people message me on Facebook, and they're like, hey, when's my story going to be up? I want people to, you know that it's possible and that we can, you know, do this together. And I'm like, you know, we're getting to it. We're getting to it. I'm only one person. You know, I don't have anybody working for me, and they're not paying anybody to do it. So just bear with me. You'll get up there. But the Voices Project, there's been a lot of talk recently about, now what do you do with it? Right. And I mean, and that's something I've had to sit down and I've had to internalize and think about. And, you know, we have seen, you know, without being partisan, we have seen some political success with it. I mean, a lot of people who told their stories and who joined this project, who kind of in a sense have become part of almost a political movement. I mean, we've had, you know, a legislator in Arizona who, you know, went off and said some really awful stuff about our community. And we made a call to action to have people, not a call to action for people to go out and beat her up, but much along the lines of what the Voices Project is, the call to action was call this legislator, tell her your story, tell her who you are, tell her that you're a voter, tell her you're a taxpayer, tell her you're struggling, whatever your story may be, tell her, identify, teach her. And they did. Thousands of people reached out to this legislator within a couple of hours. She received phone calls and emails and letters, and she issued this huge public apology within 24 hours of this statement as a result of the flood that came to her. We had a
major,
you know, a major corporation, Sephora, right? I mean, you think of makeup, you think of Sephora. Sephora brought on a Urban Decay line called Druggy, and they were marketing it with these kids, you know, looking like they were in the depths of a heroin addiction, and they called the makeup line Druggy, and somebody who was on the Voices Project reached out to us and said, hey, take a look at this. I'm going to start a petition. I think this is wrong. Like, I've lost someone, and it disgusts me, and it disgusted me. And I looked at the petition. I said, hey, you know, friends and supporters on our page, like, sign the petition. And they did. And then they started calling, and they started emailing. And just phenomenon that we saw with this legislator in Arizona duplicated itself with corporate America just a month later. And Sephora hired like one of the top PR crisis management firms in the world to deal with us. And I thought to myself, I said, this is what we need. And look at what we can do when we're unified. And we've got this constituency that wants to not just tell their story, but as a result of telling their story and hearing other stories, they want to take an action to change the system, because that's what we need. We need massive systematic change, because we've been prejudiced against, we've been discriminated, you know, and people have ignored us, but not anymore.
Yeah.
And that's really where I think that's the direction that the Voices Project is going in. And it's not a partisan effort. Look, I'm not, you know, it doesn't bother me who's president. What it does bother me is what the president or whomever the president may be at the time or a current president, what they're doing to affect my community and my people.
Right.
That's what I'm bothered with.
I get that. I completely get that. You know, it's anytime you read about anything in the news, you know, you see, oh, they're going to, you know, do this with Social Security, or they're going to do this with disability or what have you, you know, it hits me personally because, you know, like I look at my mom and her total income is Social Security, you know, or, you know, I look at us, you know, Beck's on disability and, you know, that impacts us. And anytime you've got a situation where people are being pigeonholed and it's anonymous, it's the anonymous they, you know, it's a lot easier for those in power, regardless of what side of the aisle they're on, to say negative things and do negative things to negatively impact the community in the interest of the so-called greater good. But when you call them to task and you put faces to it and you say, well, your policy is impacting me in this way, or I've been through this and this is the outcome because of what you're doing, I think it really makes them stop and think and realize, you know, my God, you know, I'm a leader of everybody in this country, not just this certain group. You know, I think it's awesome that, you know, especially with the Voices Project, you guys have been able to draw attention to what's being done negatively out there and you know, try and change some minds.
Give some examples as to what could be done positively.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
You know?
And it's really, I mean, I think really what you're saying too is it's not even I mean, yes, there's negative things going on, but we're our community is out there for impact, right? We're not just an audience. Like, we want to be an impact constituency. And that's really where I see people who are affected by substance use disorder. That's the direction of this emerging recovery movement. And almost to I'm going to I'm probably going to chop this up a little bit when I repeat what he said, but Rob Reiner, you know, who I was with on Saturday, he had a great analogy. And he said, you know, look, this is not going to happen. It all starts with really getting loud about this. It starts with us talking about it. It starts with opening a conversation. But look at disability, because you talked about people with disabilities. Like, look at where we have come. And it's taken some time. It didn't start out where it's at today. Like, first people identified, they let their voices be known. They were recognized. And then, you know, you started seeing buildings, they would build a ramp. You know, and then they would build sidebars with the ramp. And then after that, you saw them building separate entrances and then, you know, different bathrooms. And, you know, laws were changed to be more inclusive for people with disabilities. Yep. And it took time, but over time, we normalized it. It's not like this, you're waving your hands and you're like, oh, there's someone with a disability. No, you see someone and that's just... That is part of our culture. It's ingrained in our culture, but it's taking time to get there. And that's really where I would like to see us go, not just as a movement and a community, but as a country when it comes to substance use disorder issues, that it becomes normalized. It becomes a part of our culture. I think we'll save a lot of lives. I think we'll save a lot of communities, heal a lot of communities. I think that we'll have I think our economy will benefit because, you know, untreated drug addiction and alcoholism costs our economy, you know, close to $500 billion a year, and, you know, lost work productivity, increased healthcare costs, burdens on the criminal justice system, burdens on providers and insurance companies. I mean, we will be a better country when we start addressing this issue for what it is, which is a public health problem that deserves a public health response.
Exactly.
Once people start realizing that there are disabilities out there that they can't see, but that doesn't mean that they aren't valid, then we'll start finally seeing some change in the stigma that surrounds addiction, recovery, you know, mental health, all of it. Once they start to realize that just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there,
right?
Then we're going to get somewhere. And I think that's where the stage that we're at now, we're not so much fighting stigma anymore. I think that we're now trying to get to the stage of education where we're teaching people, okay, all right, you've taught me I can't do this. Tell me what I can do. And I think that's the most important stage right now is education.
I think we are, you know, I do believe we're getting, at least for addiction, we're beginning to get over a hump with stigma, and that is through education. But I can tell you, I mean, we're still way, you know, addiction recovery. I mean, we're still behind mental health. We're still behind LGBT issues. We're still behind disability. I mean, I have issues. I mean, I go to reporters, I go to big news organizations, and I say, hey, you're highlighting this amazing story about addiction recovery or someone's success story, yet the picture you're putting up on the news story, the headline photo, is like a pill bottle or a needle in a spoon. And I'm like, you know, and they realize that when I bring it to their attention. I think we haven't spent enough time educating the media on what is stigmatizing. And I think really when we can educate the media and get them on board to let them know what is stigmatizing, the AP just released their set of their writer's guidelines for journalists a couple weeks ago, and it was a seismic shift for journalism in America. They said, hey, journalists, stop referring to people who are suffering with addiction problems or who are in recovery as addicts and alcoholics. There's data behind that that shows that it is counterproductive to their movement. If you're going to use that word, use it in quotes, don't refer to someone as an addict. I mean, that's a big shtick of mine is, you know, I'm going on 3 years into recovery. I'm out there talking, advocating, working with people, helping to build a movement. And I've got people out there who are still calling me, hey, Ryan, the heroin addict. No, I mean, part of me, I can embrace that because it is part of who I am, but it is not all I am. I am so much
right.
more, and we are so much more than just an addict.
Exactly.
Do you think maybe that comes from the concept that we've heard for several years, the whole once an addict, always an addict?
Yes, I mean, a lot
that
of
we've
that,
always
we
heard.
Could do all, yeah, I mean, we could do a whole other show on that, but I mean, yes, a lot of that has been deep-rooted in certain pathways to recovery that have really, I mean, it historically have used those terms, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, once an addict, always an addict. I mean, it's been, you know, it's more of a deep-rooted cultural issue. You know, a lot of it's within 12-step. You know, there's other programs that use that type of language that has permeated outside in the media. It's permeated in writing and books. And so it's, you know, people have embraced that. But look at where we are today as a country and where we are with this public health crisis. Like, we need to embrace new ideas. We need to embrace, new pathways. We need to embrace everything that's on the table because a lot of people are dying. In fact, you know, we've been going for about an hour here. You know, by the time this podcast is over, we're looking at probably another 16 or 17 overdose deaths here in the United States. I mean,
wow.
You know, 17 more people will be 6 feet under by the time this podcast is over. So we've got to look at new methods, and all options have to be on the table.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Agreed. Well, that being said, and it has been about an hour. Unfortunately, we have to
end our time with you.
Yeah, it's been a fascinating conversation. It's been a great conversation.
We've learned a lot.
And we're so grateful to you, Ryan, for taking the time, because you are a busy guy, absolutely a busy guy. And and we appreciate you taking the time to be with us and talking with us today about, you know, this really important subject that needs the attention that you're bringing to it.
Well, thank you so much. A tremendous amount of gratitude to both you and Rebecca for doing this show and everything that you're doing. And look, I mean, keep talking mental health, you know, addiction is part of mental health. I'm going to keep talking mental health and addiction. And, you know, I do believe that we're on the right journey here. But it's going to take all of us. So thank you for giving me the time on this show today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And,
Before we let you go, could you quickly give out your social media information and your website information so everybody knows where to find you?
Sure. Anybody out there that wants to find me on the web can go to ryanhampton.org. If you'd like to tell your story or be part of the Voices Project, you can do it from there. If you're on Facebook, you could find me, Ryan Hampton. My handle is at AddictionXAmerica. On Facebook, on Twitter, I'm very responsive on there. You can reach out to me. My handle on Twitter is at Ryan for Recovery, and on Instagram, I'm at Ryan J. Hampton. Reach out to me. I'd love to hear from you.
Awesome.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, and stay on the line, folks, and we're going to cut out of here for the day, and we thank all of you for joining us. And here is David Hernandez with Beautiful.
Father in the sky, and they started to align. I see you passing by, and we're slowing down the tide. Now my love is flashing by, all I see is flashing lights. Cause you're right here by my side, can you feel it come alive? If this were a love song, would you be mine? Just can't get you off of my mind, and I think about you all day and night. So I wrote you a love song, wrote you a love song. Baby, you're beautiful. I think you're beautiful.
Join us next week as Rebecca and Joe continue to battle the stigma of mental illness. Follow us on Twitter at Voices for Change RJ and on Facebook at Voices for Change 2.0.